Welcome to NeuroNoodles Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring tech legend Jake Gunkelman. He's the man who has read well over 500,000 brain scans, and Dr. Marie Swingle, author of iMinds. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you. To this, Jay.
You've heard it all. You know all my stories.
you
can probably lip sync them.
I can't wait for Sun City.
So it should be fun. You know, we're planning a 3-day party, and you know, yeah, good science and some fun. So
speaking of sunshine,
hello.
Dr. Marie Swingle, ray of sunshine, ball of sun, ball of fire.
I'll take that. Now, I am going to give you some fire immediately. Are you ready?
Okay, holding on.
Dudes, you can't send the articles we're supposed to read at 5 a.m.
When did it go out?
I come in, I open my computer, I'm like, what? 3 more articles to read in 5 minutes?
Wait, it came out today? I sent it yesterday. Like late.
Jay, I think you sent a few out this morning, but you have no excuse because you and I are on the same timeline.
Yeah, I responded back with a few papers that could possibly be referred to, and you always like to be able to put a link to the papers and stuff. So
yeah,
no, appreciated, Pete. Did, you know, I just obviously
have here we go.
Scan them, but if we have permission to post those, I think those are what you should have in their waiting room.
Oh, perfect. Okay, what's going on?
Oh, what are we talking about?
Is that what are we talking about? Jay,
it looks like ADHD.
Yeah, it there was one in there that talked about COVID as well.
Yeah.
And talking about effective treatment of COVID as an individual case. And I've got pre-post EEGs showing effects of treatment and what long hauler COVID looks like in the EEG with ischemia. You have inflammatory changes due to the long hauler COVID, and as the immune system gets inflammation, the brain can't swell out. I mean, it's enclosed. So what happens is it pressurizes. Now it has, you know, ventricles can absorb a little bit of pressure, you know, but what happens is the pressure collapses small blood vessels. So you have small vessel ischemia, and that's seen as the slow edge of alpha, which is where you see ischemia. And the EEG can be easily seen here if I've got screen sharing. Two files, they're already opened and cleaned. This one is just brain fog cleaned, so it's ready for mapping. Here's the spectra of somebody with long hauler COVID. Now, I'm going to colorize this so you have traditional band definitions. Notice there's a outside the alpha band, too slow to be considered in the alpha band peak that sticks up in this EEG. That's where ischemia is seen. So this is long hauler COVID biomarker for somebody who's got acute brain fog. Now, I'm going to minimize this, and I'm going to minimize that. Here's the post-COVID long hauler symptom. So this is, and there's a pulse artifact. You can see, you know, he's got a beating pulse. So there will be a pulse artifact in the temporal area, but that's easily identified as a pulse artifact. And we can end up seeing the long hauler COVID change filled by band range. Now, where's the red large peak sticking up? You can see the remnants of it, but the pre-post of those two are able to be identified. Now, I don't remember which one was, here we are, 521 and 4. So this is the newer one, this is the older one. And colorizing this, the differences, you can see the things that decreased. So what decreased is the slow content, and we've got better, less slow, more of a faster. So the slow edge of alpha is what fell away, and we've got better organized and more powerful alpha itself. So pre-post treatment with neurofeedback. Now, the neurofeedback treatment ends up being essentially training neutral positive perfusion, a gentle on position. If you train the brain, you can't overactivate it, or the ischemia becomes worsened. Very much like post head injury, which is post traumatic ischemia, you have to rest. And let the brain recover before you put it back on task. If you put the brain on too much activity too early with ischemia, you basically create hypoxia, which creates edema, which creates pressure, which creates a worsening of the ischemia. If it's bad enough, if you push it hard enough, you can actually create cell death, a glutamate cascade and cell death from hypoxia. So you have to train it gently, and you train it gently with the frequencies in 11 to 16 range, which is a neutral positive perfusion. And that frequency band includes what people generally consider SMR, but obviously SMR is restricted to the central motor strip, and Barry would come back and haunt you if you called it that somewhere else, and I'd probably help him, you know. It's essentially a faster than 11 hertz alpha. Theta and alpha up to at about 11 hertz are hypoperfusion, and the neutral positive perfusion is what we need to turn on gently. The brain opens up blood vessels that have a demand. As long as you're not exceeding the supply line that's a little impaired, as long as you're not exceeding that, you're going to end up opening up a blood supply. And that's essentially what was done across time, is a gentle on opening up the blood vessels a little at a time, like the pressure of a root on a sidewalk. I mean, it's not going to break the sidewalk in a day, but it'll open it up eventually. And the SMR frequency is trained. You can go central to a temporal area or central to a frontal area, but the SMR frequencies can be trained. They can also be photobiomodulation stimulated, and you can end up helping these, you know, ischemic areas, pardon me, with 12 to 14 hertz frequency stimulation with photobiomodulation.
This in, you know, a little bit to ADHD. You know, in some of the articles you're talking about, well, not just the articles, many of us talk about, you know, ADHD is an ADHD is an ADHD. And one of the things that we sometimes see is what I call a post-viral ADHD, meaning you're working, or an exacerbation, you're working with some little munchkin. The symptoms kind of stop moving or start to get worse. And, oh yeah, you know, little so-and-so had a cold around, you know, a month ago, and they still have the sniffles. Can you speak a little bit to that, whether we put that in the same family? Do we double down, a slow down? I mean, my professional perspective is you go a little bit slower, you let the body handle this. But what are some of the clues other than, your 20 questions out front?
If you have somebody with an immune issue, I mean, if they have a cold or lingering cold, they have an immune reaction, and the immune reaction can cause similar inflammatory changes in the brain. You have to be careful of that. And the thing is, the diagnosis of ADD/ADHD doesn't really take any of that kind of stuff into account. It's simple behavioral observation and the DSM, and it doesn't take into account the ones who have epileptiform content, and it doesn't take into account whether they have frontocentral theta, which would be a more methylphenidate responder, or whether they have slow alpha in the back of the head, which should respond better to an amphetamine, or whether they have beta spindles, which should respond to a channel blocker. The classes of medication. They may have a lot of frontal alpha and need to have an antidepressant of one or another of classes, depending upon the frequency of the alpha. So, the simplistic diagnostics based on behavior have shown the total inability to predict therapy. But if you actually look at the EEG, it will tell you which of the medication classes you really need to be considering if you're going to do meds, and it picks your protocols for you if you're going to do neurofeedback. The base EEG review gives you a good, what my grandmother used to say, don't dive into the water unless you know what's under the surface. And that was pretty good advice. I mean, I've seen clinicians go in without doing assessments because that's where we started. And after QEGs came along, there was still plenty of symptom-driven protocols. But I've seen people dive in with that and hit their head on a rock. It's not always without consequence. You go in assuming beta training in an ADD kid, and they've got an epileptiform spindle, hot focus, and you trigger them up. So,
Well, for better or for worse, none of us are recommending beta training anymore. Also, looping in autism. If you have anyone who's mildly on the spectrum, you can, excuse the highly technical medical term, you can pop a kid. So be very, very careful about uptraining beta. But gosh, 20 years ago, that was pretty standard. So I mean, we learn as we go. Looping
There
back
are
though to.
circumstances where beta training ends up being of use. Actually, sometimes after teaching somebody to suppress beta, you end up having to teach them how to control the beta because having suppressed it lost a drive for them. And this has been seen in work with professional athletes, and they had difficulty with insomnia, so they learned SMR and suppressed the beta, and now they can sleep, but when they don't have their drive, so you have to teach them how to control the beta.
I'm not really worried about the adults here. That comment was for the kids, the little ones. Sorry for the interruption. I wanted to make the
Oh,
point
no.
clear. But also continuing with the alpha, one of the things, I mean, we always go read the raw data, read the raw data, read the raw data. But also in terms of, when you see low, high, low frontal alpha, is that one of the forms of ADHD or is that a viral marker? I can't tell the difference, but I know how to train it. I know why. I know the symptoms that come with it. But Jay, do you have any more insight into how we can see whether that's just, slow alpha in the front of the brain, a form of ADHD, or whether that's a marker for
It
a viral?
requires requires testing to end up having the correlation as to whether there's an immune issue. You know, years ago there was a toxic waste dumped on the town I lived in, and that we actually had a small clinic set up, and they did EEG testing on a whole bunch of people that had cognitive disturbances, and we did autoimmune biomarkers. And if you had a biomarker against your thyroid, an antibody against your thyroid, peroxidase, you ended up with frontal alpha, and you appeared depressed. And but it was an it, this was an immune issue, and the people that had autoimmune biomarkers against myelin had delta in the EEG, and they were cognitively impaired. We had a bank branch manager that could not add a string of numbers, just absolutely had lost the ability to function. And, that didn't go well, but that, the $300 million settlement, and that was the largest settlement in a long, long, long time, and there's been bigger ones since. I mean, industries being what they are, but at the time that was quite the settlement, and it was a class action and really quite the response to an industrial mess.
Jay, how does petroleum mess with the brain?
Petroleum itself has lots of different things in it. You can have very, very light things like benzene, and benzene is a carcinogen. So if you've got a refinery next to you that's emitting benzene, and they do, you can expect to have the area around it have an increased carcinogenic, it's a toxic zone. But they also can end up putting out chemicals that are reactive. The chemical that you expose to isn't emitted; it's in the it's reactive plume. What was dumped on the town wasn't the chemical that was in the plant that they were emitting. It was a polymerized form of it. Their chemical was water soluble. What we got hit in the town was sticky and wouldn't wash off. It required a solvent to take it off. So you can get reactive plume chemistry that's created downwind. If you burn the asphalt stuff downwind, you produce formaldehyde in the plume, reactive plume. So you never know. It depends upon what they're refining, how much sulfur there is in it, how well their scrubbers work. The sulfur smell that you get from refineries is either sulfur dioxide, which smells like a burnt match, or hydrogen sulfide, which smells like rotten egg. We actually had the refineries set up for the local individuals that were interested. A group came in and taught us how to smell different chemicals, and it was called Smell U, Smell University, and it was actually, the same chemical at low dose and high dose have a different odor basically as well. So individuals that had that exposure, when they smelled something, knew what they were smelling, and they could contact directly to the refinery. If you went through that, you had a number you could call and tell them, "Hey, I'm smelling this. I'm so and so," and they would respond more directly than a general call of somebody saying, "I'm something stinks over here." That doesn't give them any real clue. Is this a light hydrocarbon? Is this some stored hydrocarbon? Does it smell more like moldy? This crude, the smell you was a useful sort of experience for the local community.
Those that smelt it, dealt it.
You know, and you know, nowadays there's all sorts of community air monitoring groups, and you see scattered across the United States purple air monitors monitoring particulates and things such as that. 30-something years ago, when they dumped the toxic waste in the town I lived in, that was a brand new thing. At the time, we invented a community monitor called a bucket. It was a 5-gallon bucket with a Kevlar bag in it and a battery on the top with a little fish pump, and it would suck air in and fill the bag. You'd have to just flip a switch on and it would take a sample of air. And it was, you know, able to be sealed off and sent in for chemical analysis. And instead of having waiting for the regulator to come and, you know, show up 5 hours later when there isn't any smell, you could actually take samples. And community air monitoring was something that was an approach to things that we invented. There's actually a document, Citizen Engineers on the Fence Line. And that document goes through the entire toxic release and the community reactions. We ended up with a good neighbor agreement with the refinery, and they had about a $28 million negotiated settlement just with things that needed to be done to make them a better neighbor. Yeah. And anyway, we ended up face to face with them at a land use permit hearing, and they had just dumped 250 tons of toxic waste on our town for 16 days and didn't tell anybody. So they're going back to get their land use permit to operate the refinery for another year. It's an unincorporated township. There isn't a town. It's just a bunch of people. And, we actually had a button, JBOP, just a bunch of people. But we'd show up at hearings once in a while. And I walked into their land use permit hearing and said, you know, you can put in for a 5-minute comment, you know, on an item that's under discussion. And so I filled out my little card, and they called on me to speak. And, you know, I said, quite honestly, I'm not trying to mess with the refinery's ability to operate, because I use gas in my car, and, you know, I want just to have jet fuel and all of that. But I would like you to hold their permit in abeyance here until they come back with a good neighbor agreement. And the refinery kind of freaked out. Their lawyers objected immediately. In my time, I've got 5 minutes. He's objecting, you know. So, there's no such thing as a good neighbor agreement. They're an unincorporated township. There's nobody to negotiate with, blah, 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 you know. And the Commissioner Clark he's rolling his eyes at me, and he's looking at his watch. I'm going down in flames, you know. He says, "Okay, what's a good neighbor agreement?" And you know, this is 30 something years ago. I'm young and full of piss and vinegar. I was pissed at the refinery, and I knew I was going down in flames, so I had nothing to lose. And I turned to the refinery management and lawyers, who are kind of over next to me a little ways. I said, "Okay, we'll make an agreement. If you don't dump your garbage over the fence, I won't shoot your dog." The place came to a halt. Everybody absolutely silent, dead silent, absolutely dead silent. Commissioner Clark's eyes were big. The refinery manager lost it, stood up and said, "You don't have the right to hold our permit at all in abeyance." Commissioner Clark's nostrils flared, his eyes became big and dilated again. Down came the gavel. Boom. These hearings are held in abeyance until you come back with a good neighbor agreement. Jeez Louise, did their lawyers go crazy? They looked like the Keystone Cops for a while, bumping into each other, wondering what to do. They came over to me and complained, there isn't a town, it's an unincorporated township, there's no way to negotiate with. I said, well, how about me? Negotiate with me. So they said, well, we'll meet in 2 weeks at the refinery. I said, well, I'll get, you know, a couple people from Rodeo and a couple of people from Crockett, and we'll pop in for a meeting. And I went home shocked, actually, that it worked at all. And I still had no idea how it was going to pull off and turn out. But impudent little son of a gun, you know.
I hate to be on the other side of Jake Unkelman.
They blew it. Now, that refinery manager, I can't remember his last name, some Eastern European last name, kind of a difficult one, but it started with a P, and I can't remember how to end it. But he was canned and transferred. They don't fire him. They transfer him. And they brought in a smooth guy from L.A. to negotiate. And so I go home. And I'm thinking, my God, we've got 2 weeks to come together with what we're going to do here. And good neighbor agreement, there's never been one. So what the hell are we going to ask for, you know? And the phone rings. I get called down to a meeting in the town, and they're already there. They're all sitting at a table. When I walk in, they all look at me and they said, is it true that you are negotiating with the refinery on our behalf? And I said, yeah. And they said, what gives you the right? And I said, nothing. Why don't you guys do it? I just turned and left. And they formed a committee, and the head of the committee and whatnot, but they realized there wasn't anybody really there that knew how to play hardball poker with the management of a refinery. So they appointed me as their negotiator. And
wise choice.
$28 million later, they extended the Cumming Skyway comes to Interstate 80 and stops. Well, it could go a little bit further, about another quarter mile, and intersect with the old highway. And then all the refinery trucks go straight out to the freeway instead of going through one or the other of the two towns. So that was about an $8 million extension of a road. They agreed to do that. They put $150,000 a year for 15 years into the school system, $150,000 a year into each of the two towns, for 15 years. There were some people concerned about vision and tree. They planted trees, and now the trees block the view from spots in Rodeo where you would look over and see industrial stack. Now you see trees. All sorts of you name it. If there was an issue, bike lanes, whatever. I mean, there was somebody interested in something that became part of the negotiations. And again, a total of $28 million, including a state-of-the-art fence line detection system. And this was the hook. They agreed to a state-of-the-art, you know, and there wasn't any definition. When you make an agreement, you know, get it freaking defined, you know, at the end, before they could get their land use permit, we had to come back with an agreement, and we couldn't agree with them what the state of the art of a fence line detection system would be. And my idea was lasers. And their idea was a little pump in a shed on the fence line that would suck through a hole. If the pollution hit the hole, it would be detected by a little chemical detector. I'm shooting a meter diameter laser, a kilometer long beam, hitting a gold retroreflector, bouncing back, going through a supercooled interferometer, picking up spectral fingerprints of anything in the beam. And if you have a clean air beam that you know, you could subtract it from the beam you're recording. Kind of like EEG, there's spectral peaks and normative data. You know, and it's just a different frequency domain, but you're, you know, it's kind of like what I do with EEG, but it's just for air. And this is 30 something years ago now. So there wasn't anything like this. There were some lasers that had been used in DARPA had some in weapons inspectors after the first Iraq war. But that wasn't just general public knowledge even.
Did you build it, Jay?
we put the design in public domain so nobody could patent it.
Cool.
And it's in use now. At the time, all the air quality management district people said, what are you, crazy? Using physics to detect chemistry? That's silly. I said, well, set the crazy part aside. What about these lasers? You know, I thought they were pretty damn hot. And an infrared one, an ultraviolet one, one picks up stink and one picks up toxic. You got to have them both. And you have one upwind and one downwind on the refinery. You know exactly what they're adding. You can get a mass loading calculation. And, you know, we ended up with quite the negotiated settlement. They had to build the system that we designed. And for 20 years, it was referred to as the gold standard. There wasn't anything like it anywhere, ever, anywhere. And then the Air Quality Management District brought in advisors from, you know, Caltech and UC Systems, all sorts of engineering groups, WISPA, which is Western States Petroleum Association, and they brought in me and Denny Larson, who's passed, unfortunately. And everybody eventually agreed that the system that we had designed 20 plus years ago was now state of the art. And I'm thinking, well, we can do better than that now, you know, but still it's mandated. Every refinery in California has to have these. And in South Coast Air District, they're doing a good job managing them. The Bay Area Air Quality Management District is terrible managers. That's all. You can run these systems well, and then you can run them poorly. If you've got a clean air beam, you can see what's dirty. If you have a dirty air beam, you're clouding up the ability to see the dirty air. So,
Jay, the reason why I put us all on this tangent train was displaced persons camp, World War II. You had to put people that lost all their homes in the war in a certain place. And generally you would have depots, gas depots, can, you know, 50 gallon drums or whatever. And they'll be right next to where the people were living. And a lot of people, you know, came up with obscure, you know, brain diseases.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
I'm wondering if,
it seems to me Biden's kid ended up with brain cancer after burn pit exposure. And have you ever heard of Red Hill?
No.
In Hawaii, pollution of the groundwater, burn pit stuff and dumping, and it goes way, way, way back. It's also current. You know, they haven't stopped dumping. So I've seen a whole bunch of the EEGs of people there. They have as a general rule, they all have PTSD at this point as well. So it's
yeah, that's where I was going with it. like
Can I
now.
throw another one in,
Yeah.
Pete?
Yeah, go ahead.
That's very, very current, and I don't think is on the radar, unfortunately. But children that are living next to cement refineries, and also rock crushing sites in terms of the heavy metal dust that's floating in the air. So that's a big one also for people to check out if, you know, from ADHD to autism-like symptoms.
And the cement is created. There's kilns that burn limestone to get the cement, and that's a huge carbon dioxide. But they also have particulate release, and the cement itself, especially Portland cement, ends up having hexavalent chromium as a problem. And there was a cement grinding plant that was proposed for Vallejo, California, recently, and their planning commission denied the permit 6-1. But the city councilors council basically wanted this, and it was pretty well greased, so they called it back up. Now, I had just moved to town. I thought it had been killed. And that comes back up. The process is actually closed to public comment. You can't open up the EIR and make a comment because it's closed. We protested a little bit just to rabble the rouse. I bought a train horn. And they were going to run trains through old tracks that hadn't seen anything on them for over 50 years. And so we would stop at the various intersections and blast these train horns for 1 hour during noon hours, little pop-up protests that kind of energized the community a little bit about the issue as well.
But I
But
think if
it
Jay,
gave
you
me
know.
time to look at the EIR, and the EIR was flawed, fatally flawed. You submit an EIR under penalty of perjury that this is true and accurate to the best of your knowledge, penalty of perjury. And what I looked at in the document was basically deliberately skewed data, and not accidentally skewed. I mean, that you can make an error here or there, that happens. But when your computer modeling is all funky, somebody did this deliberately. And the Air Quality Management District tracks down to 2.5 microns. But below 2.5 microns, they don't watch that. And if you have a buoyancy coefficient or a flotation coefficient in the modeling that floats particles, you can assign the size particle that floats. So if you assign 2 microns, it's below the regulator's, area of
Right.
concern, but it floats things that aren't floatable. It 2 microns floats about like a bowling ball, but clunk. It's a particle. Bowling ball is going to land harder, but 2 microns doesn't float. 0.2 microns starts to float with Brownian motion, but 2 microns doesn't. The thing is, 1 micron particles adsorb 99% of all the heavy metal toxicity. So if you float the particles in your deposition modeling and 99% of your toxicity never comes down, what goes up does come down. We have to agree to that. And if your model shows something going up and not coming down, you better justify that somehow. And unless you can show me 2 microns floating somehow, other than having a weed blower trying to keep it in the air, I mean, it just doesn't happen. And so 99%, and that toxicity doesn't go into your health model. So all of that toxicity was not modeled in the health impacts. So I made a comment, 3-minute comment before city council, and told them that the document was a fraud and that they should sue for the perjury Yeah, they should sue the developer for submitting a false fraudulent document under penalty of perjury. The city council's all looking at their watch, this I got a 3 minutes I have to listen to this fool, and I had an acronym to remind me of all the bullet points. It spelled bullshit, and so they want a copy of my concerns. I hand them this document that spells bullshit. Anyway, it got to the air district, and the air district people were laughing so hard. I do things with a sense of humor, and buoyancy. They used rural modeling instead of urban modeling for the deposition modeling. The sampling was wrong. The temperatures, heat was off. Anyway, bullshit was the comment, and I thought that was it. They could just ignore it because the whole thing had been closed. But somehow it got to the California Attorney General's office, and they assigned a 35-year experienced EIR specialist to look at the document. She looked at it, and 2 weeks later, the city got a letter from the state Attorney General's office saying, that document you have, you can't use that document as the basis of a decision because it's not accurate. Boom, kill the project.
Jay, can I connect the dots here? Because kind of where I was going with it is, when you look for a new place to live, you see the school scores, blah blah blah. If you got young kids, don't you want to know, like, if there's a cement place next door? Are you east of it? Does the wind blow west to east? Is that all good
There's
stuff
something
that?
called a wind rose. You need to know the wind rose around any of the industrial
For mental
facilities.
health, if you got young kids or anything, like power lines, what about power lines in the backyard?
Power lines are important as well. Big EMF under power lines is a lot more than cell phones ever will produce. You can actually produce enough. If you park a car under a power line, the car will gather a charge. If you are sitting in that car under the power line for a while and you step out and your foot has a leather-soled shoe and you touch the ground and the back of your leg touches the car, you get a zap. There's a static charge built up.
Anything you can hear standing under it is not a good idea
The hum, I'm tall. I mean, I'm closer to it than I go by it, and I'm like, what are all these people living here and running? I see tracks up and down, and I can feel the.
In Crockett, they have a cogeneration power plant, and I stopped that power plant for 8.5 years, and then they re-engineered it totally along with my concerns, and we ended up giving a permit at the end of 10 years. There's a 1 year statutory guarantee for your decision in California. It took them 10 years to get this done. One of the things we made them do is bury the power lines in town. There were no standards at all, none. So, you've got a little Gauss meter. You can stand under the power lines. You can stand where something's buried. And anyway, the Energy Commission in California, I was an intervener, the power companies tried to get me thrown out as inexpert, and that didn't go well for them. I'm an electroencephalographic technologist. I measure microvolt stuff, so and I know enough about electricity, so this didn't go well for them. They didn't get me thrown out as inexpert. But the California Energy Commission had no standard. We were talking about the Swedish study and 3 milligauss being somewhat of a safe level, and the Energy Commission suggested that there is no standard, and I suggested, well, it's up to you to set the standard.
Shouldn't
And
there be one? Yeah.
They asked, well, what should the standard be? Now, you have to realize I'm kind of like the merry prankster of environmental stuff. And they asked me what the standard should be. And I've got this Gauss meter. And I said, well, if you hold the Gauss meter at testicular height, it shouldn't be more than 3 milligauss. And you could see all of the men on the panel kind of ski,
Love it, love it.
don't toast the noogies. So the
Gotta where
standard,
it counts, right?
the standard was that it should be buried in a in underground and five phase, and it shouldn't have more than 3 milligauss measured at 3 feet. They actually gave a measurement, being that testicular height was not really a specific measurement, so, but it sure got their attention.
I think we just tripped over a topic here, picking a place to live for your mental health. Serious. I never thought about that before. What mental issues you got to worry about, Jay?
I would think first of all that there are areas where you really can't get away from it. Areas in Texas and Louisiana where there's so many chemical plants and stuff that that it's considered a cancer alley. And in those circumstances, there isn't really a really safe place. You have to create an indoor sanctuary with air purifiers, and outdoor air is not pure. So those areas are really, really awful. And they've gotten citizen air monitoring going. And the citizens are identifying the chemical plants' effluents and doing class action litigation to try and clean them up. But it's a hostile environment down there administratively for getting anything done environmentally. If you're in California and you look around, there used to be a chemical plant or a refinery, a smelter, something like that, almost everywhere at some point. And if you look back historically, there are some spots that were quite toxic. In the Crockett area, which is the little town that I had lived in, between Crockett and Rodeo, there was a smelter, and it had the world's tallest smokestack, and it spewed lead and arsenic and cadmium and all sorts of heavy metals out that stack as they were refining gold and lead and all sorts of metals that were going to be used. Well, about a half a mile, three quarters of a mile away, across the body of water is a hillside. And if you grazed your horse on that hillside for 30 days, you had a 100% death rate. Now, that used to be rolling hills. Now it's all homes. They recontoured the hills to get the heavy lead topsoil sequestered. But luckily, the refinery and smelter are gone, but the oil refinery is right there in the same wind direction from the oil refinery is there is going right at them.
Jay, if you're going to pick a place to live, like how are you, what do you tell the realtor? What research do you, because they're not going to, hey, this is a great deal. Well, there's a reason why it's a great deal. It's on top of a bunch of where a place where a bunch of lead used to be.
Well, there are neighborhoods in the Bay Area, Atchison Village in Richmond, the Iron Triangle in Richmond, the that were so toxic that it's essentially low income with brownfields, fenced off areas that are too toxic to do anything with them. You see kids play baseball and stuff in those fields now. So, yes, the
Yeah, look at historical maps, I would suggest, because your real estate agent, it's going to think you're nuts and not bother with you because you're a pain in the butt. I mean, you're going to say no. They're not going to want to work with you. Sorry to the industry, but everybody wants easy clients, right? But I
In
would say,
Richmond, California, they're proposing a housing development on AstraZeneca, Superfund site. And it's got TCE buried down in the ground. They're going to put this nice slab over the top of it, but pipes are going to go through that and up all of your sewer pipes and whatnot. And eventually, if there's a leak in a sewer somewhere, the sewer vents come up through if your toilet's got a little seal break in it, you end up with TCE leaking into your building, and it'll happen. The life of the building, tell me no toilet seal's gonna ever get bumped, and anyway, the TCE causes Parkinsonism. Not exactly a great ending just for living in that building. They've been fighting it locally, fairly effectively recently, and UC Berkeley got interested in the site, and it produced quite a bit of academically supportable complaints about the remediation. Sea level rise will bring all of that up. As sea level rise happens, groundwater rise happens. And that groundwater rise brings all that stuff that's been buried up to the surface, basically.
So you just brought up water, and we'll cut it out after this. But there was a town in Michigan. They had an issue. Flint, Michigan had a problem with lead. What does lead do to the brain and mental health?
Lead is t
Kills
a
it.
neuro neurotoxic, and you can start shaving IQ points off a dozen at a time. Knock it down and down and down with more exposure. And it's cumulative. It's stored in bones. It's not a good thing at all. Now, the infrastructure grants that have come out over the last year or so are supposed to be doing sewage treatment plant replacements and upgrades, as well as sewer systems and water plant systems. So a lot of the towns that have still lead pipe delivery, and not just lead in the water, but lead in the pipes that are delivering it. Now you'd think, oh, that's somewhat some poor little rural thing and some poor backwoods area somewhere that's using lead pipes. Giant delivery pipes in San Francisco's downtown.
So that's the reason for it.
There's old town pipings that are lead. New York, Chicago, San Francisco. The communities end up having to have surveys of all of their infrastructure, and all of that should be information that's publicly accessible. The town I live has done a survey of every single piece of the sewer system and every bit of the water delivery system. And there have been significant upgrades in some of the water delivery system because of the age of some of the delivery lines,
I hate to
the
spread bad
plastic
news, but
lines that
it's
are
a new
delivering.
thing as well. I mean, some buildings even built up into the 80s, the soldering systems in them. Yeah. But one little tiny tip to kind of maybe end on a slightly positive note is run your water in the morning. If you're really, really thirsty, drink out of your bathroom tap, because generally speaking, you've been running, there's more water going through your bathroom than your kitchen in the morning. So.
Interesting. Thank you, Dr.
And
Marie.
there's filters that you can use that take out impurities. Zero is one that's really complete Brita's nice, but
Now,
it takes
careful
out
though, Jay.
things, but
You might want to
zero's a
expand a
little
bit on
more
that
pure.
because there are some that they essentially take out everything, so your body becomes completely unbalanced. So you want to have systems that take out the heavy metals, etc., but don't deplete vitamins, etc.
Fluoride. Do I need fluoride in my drinking water, really?
Well, the communities that don't have the fluoride in the drinking water end up having horrible dental caries as an issue. So,
Ireland.
as a general public health, it's probably better than not. And I don't think there's a gigantic negative with that.
All right.
I have to say, however, that if you fluoridate or chlorine or fluoride in water systems, end up interacting with biologicals in them and producing chloroform. And the levels of chloroform in water supplies are, you have to be notified of it. And here locally, we've received notice that they're in an excess 1/4 of the last 5 quarters on the amount of chloroform because of some excess chlorine being added because of some increased biologicals from the water supply. But that was during drought, and the water quality, when you start to get down to the bottom of the tap,
But
gets a
there's
little funky.
politics in
So.
here too, because I know here locally we had an issue with individuals with compromised immune systems, so there was a push in the city to up the level of chlorine. But there's a big balance in terms of, one population that's compromised that could compromise the other. But I guess bottom line, if there's a take home, is a lot of the people that are supposed to be in politics to protect are grossly naive. So everybody has to do their own due diligence without tipping over, to conspiracy,
Right.
So it's a tough walk. It's a tough walk.
A tough walk is figuring out this show, and I got to edit it. I don't know
Where
Jay.
do we start and where do we end, you
I
know?
don't know. Jay Gunkelman, Dr. Marie Swingle, another interesting episode of the Neuro Noodle Network podcast.
You never know where the noodle will take
We'll
off to,
doodle
you know.
the noodle ride.
If any listeners would suggest a title and YouTube description for this podcast, reach out to Pete at neuronoodle.com. Everyone, have a great weekend. The Neuro Noodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you.